Susan didn't like beers, but she went there anyway when the pressure of being normal got too much. Beers, despite the smell and the drink and the company, had one important virtue. In beers, no one took any notice of anything. Hog's Watch was traditionally supposed to be a time for families, but the people who drank in beers probably didn't have families. Some of them looked as though they might have had litters or clutches. Some of them looked as though they'd probably eaten their relatives, or at least someone's relatives. Beers was where the undead drank. And when Igor the barman was asked for a Bloody Mary, he didn't mix a metaphor. The regular customers didn't ask questions, and not only because some of them found anything above a growl hard to articulate. None of them was in the answers business. Everyone in beers drank alone, even when they were in groups or packs. Despite the decorations put up inexpertly by Igor the barman to show willing, beers was not a family place. He'd done his best, but black and purple and vomit yellow weren't a good colour combination for paper chains, and no Hogswatch fairy doll should be nailed up by its head. Family was a subject Susan liked to avoid. Currently, she was being aided in this by a gin and tonic. In beers, unless you weren't choosy, it paid to order a drink that was transparent because Igor also had undirected ideas about what you could stick on the end of a cocktail stick. If you saw something spherical and green, you just had to hope that it was an olive. She felt hot breath on her ear. A bogeyman had sat down on the stool beside her.
"Was a normal doing in a place like this, then?"
it rumbled, causing a cloud of vaporized alcohol and halitosis to engulf her.
"Ha! You think it's cool coming down here and swanning around in a black dress with all the lost boys, huh? Dabbling in a bit of designer darkness, huh?"
Susan moved her stool away a little. The bogeyman grinned.
"Want a bogeyman under your bed, hmm?" "Now then, Schlimmerzel," said Igor, without looking up from polishing a glass. "Well, what's she down here for, hmm?"
said the bogeyman. A huge, hairy hand grabbed Susan's arm.
"Of course, maybe what she wants is..." "I ain't telling you again, Schlimmerzel," said Igor.
He saw the girl turn to face Schlimmerzel. Igor wasn't in a position to see her face fully, but the bogeyman was. He shot back so quickly that he fell off his stool. And when the girl spoke, what she said was only partly words, but also a statement, written in stone, of how the future was going to be. "Go away and stop bothering me." She turned back and gave Igor a polite and slightly apologetic smile. The bogeyman struggled frantically out of the wreckage of his stool and loped towards the door. Susan felt the drinkers turn back to their private preoccupations. It was amazing what you could get away with in beers. Igor put down the glass and looked up at the window. For a drinking den that relied on darkness, it had rather a large one. But of course, some customers did arrive by air. Something was tapping on it now. Igor lurched over and opened it. Susan looked up. Oh, no. The Death of Rats leapt down onto the counter, with the raven fluttering after it.
"Squeak, squeak, ick, ick, squeak, ick, ick, heek, 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 squeak."
"Go away," said Susan coldly. "I'm not interested. You're just a figment of my imagination." The raven perched on a bowl behind the bar and said,
"Oh, great."
"Squeak."
"What are these?" said the raven, flicking something off the end of its beak. "Onions. Pfft."
"Go on, go away, the pair of you," said Susan.
"The rat says your grandad's gone mad," said the raven. "Says he's pretending to be the hog father."
"Listen, I just..." "What?"
"Red cloak, long beard,
heek, heek, heek.
Going ho, 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 driving around in the big sledge drawn by the four piggies, the whole thing."
"Pigs? What happened to Binky?"
"Search me. Course it can happen, as I was telling the rat only just now."
Susan put her hands over her ears, more for desperate theatrical effect than for the muffling they gave.
"I don't want to know. I don't have a grandfather."
She had to hold on to that. The Death of Rats squeaked at length.
"The rat says you must remember he's tall, not what you'd call fleshy. He carries a scythe."
"Go away and take the rat with you." She waved her hand wildly, and to her horror and shame, knocked the little hooded skeleton over an ashtray.
Eek!
The raven took the rat's cowl in its beak and tried to drag him away, but a tiny skeletal fist shook its scythe.
Eek! 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 Squeak! He says you don't mess with the rat, said the raven.
In a flurry of wings, they were gone. Igor closed the window. He didn't pass any comment. They weren't real, said Susan hurriedly. Well, that is, the raven's probably real, but he hangs around with the rat.
Which isn't real, said Igor.
That's right, said Susan gratefully. You probably didn't see a thing.
That's right, said Igor. Not a thing.
Now, how much do I owe you? Said Susan. Igor counted on his fingers.
That'll be $1 for the drinks, he said, and 5 pence because the raven that wasn't here messed in the pickles.
It was the night before Hogswatch. In the Arch-Chancellor's new bathroom, Modo wiped his hands on a piece of rag and looked proudly at his handiwork. Shining porcelain gleamed back at him. Copper and brass shone in the lamplight. He was a little worried that he hadn't been able to test everything, but Mr. Ridcully had said, "I'll test it when I use it." And Modo never argued with the gentlemen, as he thought of them. He knew that they all knew a lot more than he knew, and was quite happy knowing this. He didn't meddle with the fabric of time and space, and they kept out of his greenhouses. The way he saw it, it was a partnership. He'd been particularly careful to scrub the floors. Mr. Ridcully had been very specific about that.
"Veruca gnome," he said to himself, giving a tap a last polish. "What an imagination the gentlemen do have!"
Far off, unheard by anyone, was a faint little noise, like the ringing of tiny silver bells. Gling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. And someone landed abruptly in a snowdrift and said, "Bugger," which is a terrible thing to say as your first word ever. Overhead, heedless of the new and somewhat angry life that was even now dusting itself off, the sledge soared onwards through time and space.
"I'm finding the beard a bit of a trial," said Death.
"Why have you got to have the beard?" said the voice from among the sacks. "I thought you said people see what they expect to see."
"Children don't. Too often they see what's there."
"Well, at least it's keeping you in the right frame of mind, Master. In character sort of thing."
"But going down the chimney, where's the sense in that? I can just walk through the walls."
Walking through the walls is not right neither," said the voice from the sacks.
"It works for me."
It's got to be chimneys, same as the beard, really."
A head thrust itself out from the pile. It appeared to belong to the oldest, most unpleasant pixie in the universe. The fact that it was underneath a jolly little green hat with a bell on it did not do anything to improve matters. It waved a crabbed hand containing a thick wad of letters, many of them on pastel-coloured paper, often with bunnies and teddy bears on them, and written mostly in crayon.
"You reckon these little buggers be writing to someone who walked through walls?" it said. "And the ho-ho-ho could use some more work, if you don't mind my saying so."
"Ho, ho, ho."
"No, no, no," said Albert. "You got to put a bit of life in it, sir. No offence intended. It's got to be a big fat laugh. You got to sound like you're pissing brandy and crapping plum pudding, sir. Excuse my clatching."
"Really? How do you know all this?"
"I was young once, sir. Hung up my stocking like a good boy every year, for to get it filled with toys, just like you're doing. Mind you, in those days, basically it was sausages and black puddings, if you were lucky. But you always got a pink sugar piglet in the toe. It wasn't a good hog's watch, unless you'd eaten so much you were sick as a pig, Master."
Death looked at the sacks. It was a strange but demonstrable fact that the sacks of toys carried by the Hogfather, no matter what they really contained, always appeared to have sticking out of the top a teddy bear, a toy soldier in the kind of colourful uniform that would stand out in a disco, a drum, and a red and white candy cane. The actual contents always turned out to be something a bit garish and costing $5.99. Death had investigated one or two. There had been a real Agatean ninja, for example, with fearsome death grip, and a Captain Carrot one-man night watch, with a complete wardrobe of toy weapons, each of which cost as much as the original wooden doll in the first place. Mind you, the stuff for girls was just as depressing. It seemed to be nearly all horses. Most of them were grinning. Horses, Death felt, shouldn't grin. Any horse that was grinning was planning something. He sighed again. Then there was this business of deciding who'd be naughty or nice. He'd never had to think about that sort of thing before. Naughty or nice. It was ultimately all the same. Still, it had to be done right, otherwise it wouldn't work. The pigs pulled up alongside another chimney.
Here we are, said Albert. James Riddle, aged 8.
Ah, yes. He actually says in his letter, I bet you don't exist, 'cause everyone knows it's your parents. Oh, yes, said Death, with what almost sounded like sarcasm. I'm sure his parents are just impatient to bang their elbows in 12 feet of narrow, unswept chimney, I don't think. I shall tread extra soot into his carpet.
Right, sir. Good thinking. Speaking of which, down you go, sir.
How about if I don't give him anything as a punishment for not believing?
Yeah, but what's that going to prove?
Death sighed.
I suppose you're right.
Did you check the list?
Yes, twice. Are you sure that's enough?
Definitely.
Couldn't really make head or tail of it, to tell you the truth. How can I tell if he's been naughty or nice, for example?
Ah, well, I don't know. Has he hung his clothes up, that sort of thing?
And if he has been good, I may give him this Clatchian war chariot with real spinning sword blades?
That's right.
And if he's been bad?
Albert scratched his head.
When I was a lad, you got a bag of bones. It's amazing how kids got better behaved towards the end of the year.
Oh, dear. And now?
Albert held a package up to his ear and rustled it.
Sounds like socks.
Socks?
Could be a woolly vest.
Serve him right, if I may venture to express an opinion.
Albert looked across the snowy rooftops and sighed. This wasn't right. He was helping because, well, Death was his master, and that's all there was to it. And if the master had a heart, it would be in the right place. But
are you sure we ought to be doing this, master?
Death stopped, halfway out of the chimney.
Can you think of a better alternative, Albert?
And that was it. Albert couldn't. Someone had to do it. There were bears on the street again. Susan ignored them and didn't even make a point of not treading on the cracks. They just stood around, looking a bit puzzled and slightly transparent, visible only to children and Susan. News like Susan gets around. The bears had heard about the poker.
Nuts and berries, their expressions seemed to say. That's what we're here for. Big sharp teeth? What big sharp? Oh, these big sharp teeth. They're just for, cracking nuts. And some of these berries can be really vicious.
The city's clocks were striking 6 when she got back to the house. She was allowed her own key. It wasn't as if she was a servant, exactly. You couldn't be a duchess and a servant. But it was all right to be a governess. It was understood that it wasn't exactly what you were. It was merely a way of passing the time until you did what every girl, or gal, was supposed to do in life, i.e. marry some man. It was understood that you were playing. The parents were in awe of her. She was the daughter of a duke, whereas Mr. Gator was a man to be reckoned with in the wholesale boots and shoes business. Mrs. Gator was bucking for a transfer into the upper classes, which she currently hoped to achieve by reading books on etiquette. She treated Susan with the kind of worried deference she thought was due to anyone who'd known the difference between a serviette and a napkin from birth. Susan had never before come across the idea that you could rise in society by, as it were, gaining marks, especially since such noblemen as she'd met in her father's house had used neither serviette nor napkin, but a state of mind which was, drop it on the floor, the dogs will eat it. When Mrs. Gator had tremulously asked her how one addressed the second cousin of a queen, Susan had replied without thinking, "We called him Jamie, usually," and Mrs. Gator had had to go and have a headache in her room. Mr. Gator just nodded when he met her in a passage and never said very much to her. He was pretty sure he knew where he stood in boots and shoes, and that was that. Gawain and Twyla, who'd been named by people who apparently loved them, had been put to bed by the time Susan got in, at their own insistence. It's a widely held belief at a certain age that going to bed early makes tomorrow come faster. She went to tidy up the schoolroom and get things ready for the morning, and began to pick up the things the children had left lying around. Then something tapped at a window pane. She peered out at the darkness and then opened the window. A drift of snow fell down outside. In the summer, the window opened into the branches of a cherry tree. In the winter dark, they were little grey lines where the snow had settled on them. "Who's that?" said Susan. Something hopped through the frozen branches.
"Tweet, tweet, tweet, would you believe?" said the raven.
"Not you again.
You wanted maybe some dear little robin. Listen, your grandfather—"
"Go away."
Susan slammed the window and pulled the curtains across. She put her back to them to make sure and tried to concentrate on the room. It helped to think about normal things. There was the Hog's Watch tree, a rather smaller version of the grand one in the hall. She'd helped the children to make paper decorations for it. Yes. Think about that. There were the paper chains. There were the bits of holly thrown out from the main rooms for not having enough berries on them, and now given fake modelling clay berries and stuck in anyhow on shelves and behind pictures. There were two stockings hanging from the mantelpiece of the small schoolroom grate. There were Twyla's paintings, all blobby blue skies and violently green grass and red houses with four square windows. There were normal things. She straightened up and stared at them, her fingernails beating a thoughtful tattoo on a wooden pencil case. The door was pushed open. It revealed the tousled shape of Twyla, hanging onto the doorknob with one hand.
"Susan, there's a monster under my bed again."
The click of Susan's fingernails stopped.
"I can hear it moving about."
Susan sighed and turned towards the child. "All right, Twyla, I'll be along directly." The girl nodded and went back to her room, leaping into bed from a distance as a precaution against claws. There was a metallic zing as Susan withdrew the poker from the little brass stand it shared with the tongs and the coal shovel. She sighed. Normality was what you made it. She went into the children's bedroom and leaned over as if to tuck Twyla up. Then her hand darted down and under the bed. She grabbed a handful of hair. She pulled. The bogeyman came out like a cork, but before it could get its balance, it found itself spread-eagled against the wall with one arm behind its back. But it did manage to turn its head to see Susan's face glaring at it from a few inches away. Gawain bounced up and down on his bed.
"Do the voice on it! Do the voice on it!" he shouted.
"Don't do the voice! Don't do the voice!"
pleaded the bogeyman urgently.
"Hit it on the head with the poker!"
"Not the poker! Not the poker!"
"It's you, isn't it?" said Susan, "from this afternoon."
"Aren't you going to poke it with the poker?" said Gawain.
"Not the poker!"
whined the bogeyman.
"New in town?" whispered Susan.
"Yes."
The bogeyman's forehead wrinkled with puzzlement.
"Here, how come you can see me?"
"Then this is a friendly warning, understand? Because it's Hog's Watch." The bogeyman tried to move.
"You call this friendly?"
"Ah, you want to try for unfriendly?" said Susan, adjusting her grip.
"No, no, no. I like friendly."
"This house is out of bounds, right?"
"You a witch or something?"
moaned the bogeyman. "I'm just something. Now, you won't be around here again, will you? Otherwise it'll be the blanket next time."
"No."
"I mean it. We'll put your head under the blanket."
"No."
"It's got fluffy bunnies on it."
"No."
"Off you go, then."
The bogeyman half fell, half ran towards the door.
"It's not right," it mumbled. "You're not supposed to see us if you ain't dead or magic. It's not fair."
"Try number 19, said Susan, relenting a little. "The governess there doesn't believe in bogeymen."
"Right," said the monster hopefully.
"She believes in algebra, though."
"Oh, nice."
The bogeyman grinned hugely. It was amazing the sort of mischief that could be caused in a house where no one in authority thought you existed.
"I'll be off then," it said. "Happy Hog's Watch."
"Possibly," said Susan, as it slunk away.
"That wasn't as much fun as the one last month," said Gawain, getting between the sheets again. "You know, when you kicked him in the trousers."
"Just you two get to sleep now," said Susan.
"Verity said the sooner we got to sleep, the sooner the Hogfather would come," said Twyla conversationally.
"Yes," said Susan. "Unfortunately, that might be the case." The remark passed right over their heads.
She wasn't sure why it had gone through hers, but she knew enough to trust her senses. She hated that kind of sense. It ruined your life, but it was the sense she had been born with. The children were tucked in, and she closed the door quietly and went back to the schoolroom. Something had changed. She glared at the stockings, but they were unfulfilled. A paper chain rustled. She stared at the tree. Tinsel had been twined around it, badly pasted together decorations had been hung on it, and on top was the fairy made of... She crossed her arms, looking up at the ceiling, and sighed theatrically. "It's you, isn't it?" she said.
"Squeak."
"Yes, it is. You're sticking out your arms like a scarecrow, and you've stuck a little star on your scythe, haven't you?" The Death of Rats hung his head guiltily.
"Squeak."
"You're not fooling anyone."
"Squeak."
"Get down from there this minute."
"Squeak."
"And what did you do with the fairy?"
"It's shoved under a cushion on the chair," said a voice from the shelves on the other side of the room.
There was a clicking noise, and the raven's voice added,
"These damn eyeballs are hard, aren't they?"
Susan raced across the room and snatched the bowl away so fast that the raven somersaulted and landed on its back. "They are walnuts," she shouted as they bounced around her, "not eyeballs. This is a schoolroom, and the difference between a school and a raven delicatessen is that they hardly ever have eyeballs lying around in bowls in case a raven drops in for a quick snack. Understand? No eyeballs. The world is full of small round things that aren't eyeballs, okay?" The raven's own eyes revolved.
"And I suppose a bit of warm liver's out of the question?"
"Shut up. I want you both out of here right now. I don't know how you got in here."
"There's a law against coming down the chimney on Hog's Watch night."
"But I don't want you back in my life. Understand?"
"The rat said you ought to be warned even if you were crazy," said the raven sulkily. "I didn't want to come. There's a donkey dropped dead just outside the city gates. I'll be lucky now if I get a hoof."
"Warned," said Susan. There it was again, the change in the weather of the mind, a sensation of tangible time. The Death of Rats nodded. There was a scrabbling sound far overhead. A few flakes of soot dropped down the chimney.
"Squeak,"
said the rat, but very quietly. Susan was aware of a new sensation, as a fish might be aware of a new tide, a spring of fresh water flowing into the sea. Time was pouring into the world. She glanced up at the clock. It was just on 6:30. The raven scratched its beak.
"The rat says... The rat says you'd better watch out."
There were others at work on this shining Hog's Watch Eve. The Sandman was out and about, dragging his sack from bed to bed. Jack Frost wandered from window pane to window pane, making icy patterns. And one tiny hunched shape slid and slithered along the gutter, squelching its feet in slush and swearing under its breath. It wore a stained black suit, and on its head the type of hat known in various parts of the multiverse as bowler, derby, or the one that makes you look a bit of a tit. The hat had been pressed down very firmly, and since the creature had long pointy ears, these had been forced out sideways and gave it the look of a small, malignant wingnut. The thing was a gnome by shape, but a fairy by profession. Fairies aren't necessarily little twinkie creatures. It's purely a job description, and the commonest ones aren't even visible, such as the electric drill chuck key fairy. A fairy is simply any creature currently employed under supernatural laws to take things away, or, as in the case of the small creature presently climbing up the inside of a drainpipe and swearing, to bring things. Oh, yes, he does. Someone has to do it, and he looks like the right gnome for the job. Oh, yes. Sidney was worried. He didn't like violence, and there had been a lot of it in the last few days, if days passed in this place. The men, well, they only seemed to find life interesting when they were doing something sharp to someone else, and while they didn't bother him much in the same way that lions don't trouble themselves with ants, they certainly worried him. But not as much as Tea Time did. Even the brute called Chicken Wire treated Tea Time with caution, if not respect, and the monster called Banjo just followed him around like a puppy. The enormous man was watching him now. He reminded Sidney too much of Ronnie Jenks, the bully who'd made his life miserable at Gamma Wimblestone's dame school. Ronnie hadn't been a pupil. He was the old woman's grandson or nephew or something, which gave him a license to hang around the place and beat up any kid smaller or weaker or brighter than he was, which more or less meant he had the whole world to choose from. In those circumstances, it was particularly unfair that he always chose Sidney. Sidney hadn't hated Ronnie. He'd been too frightened. He'd wanted to be his friend. Oh, so much. Because that way, just possibly, he wouldn't have had his head trodden on such a lot and would actually get to eat his lunch instead of having it thrown in the privy. And it had been a good day when it had been his lunch. And then, despite all Ronnie's best efforts, Sidney had grown up and gone to university. Occasionally his mother told him how Ronnie was getting on. She assumed, in the way of mothers, that because they had been small boys at school together, they had been friends. Apparently he ran a fruit stall and was married to a girl called Angie, who was, according to Sidney's mother, a bit of a catch, since her father owned a half share in an eel pie shop in Gleam Street. You must know her. Got all her own teeth and a wooden leg you'd hardly notice. Got a sister called Continence. Lovely girl. Why didn't she invite her along for tea next time he was over? Not that she hardly saw her son, the big wizard, at all these days, but you never knew, and if the magic thing didn't work out, then a quarter share in a thriving eel pie business was not to be sneezed at. This was not enough punishment, Sidney considered. Banjo even breathed like Ronnie, who had to concentrate on such an intellectual exercise and always had one blocked nostril, and his mouth open all the time. He looked as though he was living on invisible plankton. He tried to keep his mind on what he was doing and ignore the laboured gurgling behind him. A change in its tone made him look up. "Fascinating," said Tea Time. "You make it look so easy." Sidney sat back nervously.
It should be fine now, sir," he said. "It just got a bit scuffed when we were piling up the..."
He couldn't bring himself to say it. He even had to avert his eyes from the heap. It was the sound they'd made.
The things, he finished.
"We don't need to repeat the spell," said Tea Time.
"Oh, it'll keep going forever," said Sidney. "The simple ones do. It's just a state change powered by the... It just keeps going." He swallowed.
"So," he said, "I was, thinking, since you don't actually need me, sir, perhaps..." "Mr. Brown seems to be having some trouble with the locks on the top floor," said Tea Time. "That door we couldn't open, remember? I'm sure you'll want to help."
Sidney's face fell.
I'm not a locksmith."
"They appear to be magical."
Sidney opened his mouth to say, "But I'm very bad at magical locks," and then thought much better of it. He had already fathomed that if Tea Time wanted you to do something and you weren't very good at it, then your best plan, in fact, quite possibly your only plan, was to learn to be good at it very quickly. Sidney was not a fool. He'd seen the way the others reacted around Tea Time, and they were men who did things he'd only dreamed of. Not, that is, things he wanted to do or wanted done to him, just things that he dreamed of in the armpit of a bad night. At which point he was relieved to see Medium Dave walk down the stairs, and it said a lot for the effect of Tea Time's stare that anyone could be relieved to have it punctuated by someone like Medium Dave.
"We've found another guard, sir, up on the sixth floor. He's been hiding."
Tea Time stood up.
"Oh, dear," he said. "Not trying to be heroic, was he?"
"He's just scared. Shall we let him go?"
"Let him go," said Tea Time. "Far too messy. I'll go up there. Come along, Mr. Wizard."
Sidney followed him reluctantly up the stairs. The tower, if that's what it was, he thought — he was used to the odd architecture at Unseen University, and this made UU look normal — was a hollow tube. No fewer than 4 spiral staircases climbed the inside, crisscrossing on landings and occasionally passing through one another in defiance of generally accepted physics. But that was practically normal for an alumnus of Unseen University, although technically Sidney had not alummed. What threw the eye was the absence of shadows. You didn't notice shadows, how they delineated things, how they gave texture to the world, until they weren't there. The white marble, if that's what it was, seemed to glow from the inside. Even when the impossible sun shone through a window, it barely caused faint grey smudges where honest shadows should be. The tower seemed to avoid darkness. That was even more frightening than the times when, after a complicated landing, you found yourself walking up, by stepping down the underside of a stair, and the distant floor now hung overhead like a ceiling. He'd noticed that even the other men shut their eyes when that happened. Tea Time, though, took these stairs three at a time, laughing like a kid with a new toy. They reached an upper landing and followed a corridor. The others were gathered by a closed door.
He's barricaded himself in, said Chicken Wire.
Tea Time tapped on it.
You in there, he said. Come on out. You have my word you won't be harmed.
No.
Tea Time stood back.
Banjo, knock it down, he said.
Banjo lumbered forward. The door withstood a couple of massive kicks and then burst open. The guard was cowering behind an overturned cabinet. He cringed back as Tea Time stepped over it.
What are you doing here? He shouted. Who are you?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. I'm your worst nightmare, said Tea Time cheerfully. The man shuddered.
You mean the one with the giant cabbage and the sort of whirring knife thing?
Sorry? Tea Time looked momentarily nonplussed.
Then you're the one about where I'm falling, only instead of ground underneath, it's all...
No, in fact, I'm... The guard sagged.
Oh, not the one where there's all this kind of, you know, mud, and then everything goes blue, and...
No, I'm... Oh, shit.
Then you're the one where there's this door, only there's no floor beyond it, and then there's these claws, and...
No, said Tea Time, not that one. He withdrew a dagger from his sleeve.
I'm the one where this man comes out of nowhere and kills you stone dead.
The guard grinned with relief.
Oh, that one, he said.
But that one's not very fr... He crumpled around Tea Time's suddenly outthrust fist. And then, just like the others had done, he faded.
Rather a charitable act there, I feel, Tea Time said as the man vanished. But it is nearly Hogswatch after all.